This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with Abby Jacobson and Ilana Glazer, the creators and stars of Comedy Central's Broad City. But first, let's listen to Terry's conversation with Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette. They star in the film Boyhood and earlier this week received Oscar nominations for their roles. Boyhood earned a total of 6 Oscar nominations, including one for Best Picture, and last week won 3 Golden Globe Awards. There's never been a film quite like Boyhood, a fiction film in which Arquette and Hawke play the divorced parents of 2 children. It takes place over the course of 12 years and was shot over the course of 12 years, filming several days each year. As the actors age, we see the characters age. It's especially dramatic to watch the children. The youngest, Mason Jr., played by L.R. Coltrane, is a 7-year-old first grader when the movie begins. He's 19 and beginning college when the movie concludes. Boyhood follows the mother as she does her best to raise her children in periods when she's single, remarried, and re-divorced. The father, as he develops his weekend relationship with his children and struggles to sort out his own identity as an adult, and it follows the 2 siblings as they grow up. Ethan Hawke's made several films with Richard Linklater, including Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight. He was a child actor who really first got noticed in the 1989 film Dead Poets Society. Patricia Arquette's from an acting family. She co-starred in the 1993 cult film True Romance, recently starred in the TV series Medium, had a recurring role on Boardwalk Empire, and stars in the new series CSI Cyber.
Ethan Hawke, Patricia Arquette, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your performance in this film. It's such a special movie, so thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
As a viewer, it was an amazing experience for me to watch every character, every main character in this movie, age in each scene. You know, because by the time the movie's over, you're each 12 years older. What was the experience like for you of watching the completed film?
It was incredible in many levels. I'd never seen the scenes that Ethan was in with the kids, and the kids were in without my character. So that was one whole thing, but also our own real lives. We had 400 people on the crew. We worked with each other every year. And so while I was watching the movie, maybe my character was getting remarried, but I also had the memory of someone on the crew or someone in the cast getting divorced that year or having a baby that year. So it was multiple levels of watching it. But, you know, old people always say to you your whole life, well, enjoy this time. It goes really fast. It goes really fast. And in watching the movie, I think you see the rapid life cycle of humans, and it really does go fast.
It's strange. It was hard not to think about when Rick first told me about this idea. You know, he was talking about how there's this lie in every film, even the best ones, about childhood. This little tiny lie you have to accept that somehow some enlightenment moment happens in one moment, rather than being in a series of moments when we come of age. You know, they may come to feel like one, but he was saying, wouldn't it be amazing to make a movie where we actually just captured all the little moments? The feeling of growing up could actually be tactile. And I know the children look so different, and I gather from reviews, Patricia and I look different, but I feel like the same person, you know? And even as I watch the movie, I often get asked, what's it like to watch yourself age? For me, the remarkable thing about the movie is that I watch people maturing. That's so interesting that I actually didn't get really hung up on my own face cracking or anything like that.
Also, as an actress, for me, I mean, I think there's such a pressure in the world for women to look a certain way, especially if you have success at a certain moment in your life in this ingenue age group, that you're supposed to hold on to that. And I really wanted to move away from that status as quickly as possible.
I just want to say, I'm just so grateful. Like, in the role, in the movie, your weight fluctuates. Sometimes you weigh more, sometimes you weigh less, like in real life people do. And as you get a little older in the movie, you don't have plastic surgery, which there's so much pressure on actresses to do that. And as somebody who's not an actress, I don't want to feel like that my aging face is somehow hideous because the new norm is cosmetic surgery, and that if you don't have it, you're going to look peculiar or ugly. Like, why why would we want that to be the norm?
I don't know.
Because we're afraid.
We've gone through a distortion of some sort. I was joking with Rick towards the end. You better finish up your movie because I need to get a facelift. But I don't know. It's a very strange thing. We're you know, if you look at paintings throughout history of female beauty, the one that we're creating right now is a really weird one.
That's true. Patricia, you said you didn't see the whole movie until it was completed. Was that something that Richard Linklater wanted of the actors, to not see it till it was done, or was that your choice?
It was different with each person. Ethan saw it almost every year, or pieces of it every other year or something. I saw a rough cut at 5 years. Rick didn't really want the kids to see it. I mean, he would have shown it to them had they asked, but they never asked. He didn't want them to become self-conscious. But when the movie was finished, he gave Eller and Samantha each copies of the movie. I mean, copies of the movie to watch alone. But I wanted a way to see it with an audience, so I actually saw it for the first time at Sundance. But what I was referring to was every year Rick would call us several months before and talk about that year's work and the scenes that we would be in. He would tell me, well, their dad's going to take them camping this year. But I wouldn't get a copy of those lines to learn. So it was only when I saw the movie that my character was seeing the movie, all the scenes she wasn't in. And my character, who really resented her ex-husband for many things, in seeing the movie, also saw what an incredible dad he was. That was a real revelation for me as a human being.
And Ethan, you decided to watch the movie as it was made each year. Why was that your choice?
Well, because my relationship with Rick is a little different. You know, while we were making Boyhood, during that time period, I co-wrote 2 movies with Rick. I acted in, I think, 4 others. This movie is an extension of a kind of ethos that we've been working on, you know, kind of since we met on Before Sunrise. And so I got to kind of ride shotgun on the whole deal. And, you know, he knows me well enough. Actors are funny. You don't... Trust is a hard thing to build, and directors need trust when you show work when the paint is still wet, because the actor can freak out and not continue their work in the same way. But Rick and I we've gone beyond that 8 movies in, you know.
I have very little ability to see into the future, to imagine the future. So when Richard Linklater pitched the idea to you of a movie that would take 12 years to shoot, could you actually feel confident that there would be 12 years, that you'd finish the movie, that you could really make that kind of commitment, that you'd remain interested that long, that it would get finished? You know, all that stuff that's so hard to imagine.
Well, I was just terribly excited by the idea. I always wanted to work with Ethan. I loved his work as an actor. And I wanted to work with Rick. I loved his movies. And this concept was really exciting to me. And I was amazed that they could get financing for something that wouldn't see any return for 13 years. There was points in time along the way where I thought, okay, we're 7 years in. If this falls apart right now, this will be a real drag.
Colossal waste of time.
Yeah.
For me, it was so simple and easy. It was a total spontaneous response. He presented this concept to us. It wasn't a script. It wasn't an outline. It was a conversation that Rick offered us. You know, it was a shared goal of, wouldn't it be amazing to make a movie about childhood and take 12 years to do it? And the answer is yes. And I knew he was offering me, you know, Patricia was being offered to do a portrait of motherhood and I a portrait of fatherhood. And we were being offered a job no 2 actors have been offered before in the history of acting, you know, to get to create a character and use time as our clay to shape somebody the way life shapes us. It felt so new and original that I couldn't imagine that my DNA would shift such that I wouldn't be interested in this 15 years from now. I would.
No, of course, you were both adults and both professional actors, but the children in it were children. I mean, Lorelei Linkletter is Richard Linkletter's son, so he could vouch so he could vouch for, you know, the parent would want the child to remain committed. But, you know, Eller Coltrane, the son in the film, you know, the actor who plays the son in the film, he was six. And, I mean, how do you know that a six-year-old, A, is going to remain interested and, B, remain good enough? So, you know, 10 years from now, they'd still have some charisma on screen. They'd be able to carry.
Look, let's face it, you don't know that. It's an act of faith.
Well, did that make you nervous, signing on to the project?
Well, I knew that if Eller wasn't an artist, if that didn't come to be, that the movie wouldn't work. But there are a lot of gambles in trying to do anything unique. And I have great faith in Rick, in his ability to, I mean, you know, it's a chicken and egg situation too. You know, I mean, it's like Eller went to a theater camp with Richard Linkletter for 12 years. I mean, Rick's a great coach and Eller's a special kid. And yeah, we got lucky, but you know, luck is a residue of design, right? I mean, a lot of effort and love went into creating a space that was available for them to use their creativity to a positive end. And so, yeah, it the greatest blessing on the movie is the fact that Eller turned out to be James Dean, you know? Yeah. I mean, of course, it seems preposterous now. And yet, you know, Rick's kind of a touched guy. He's not ordinary.
Also, you know, Rick jokes about the casting process like it was trying to find the Dalai Lama. I mean, Eller had already chosen acting as something he was interested in. They had about 9 meetings that really consisted of Eller bringing in drawings, talking about music. So Rick kind of had a
feel
for...
When he was six?
Yeah.
Yeah.
During the audition process, and also Rick spending time with Eller's parents, because Rick says much of the casting is as much about the parents. And Eller's parents are exceptional people, really artistic, thoughtful, interesting,
beautiful,
emotional
thinkers. And they wanted their son to have, you know, they knew who Linkletter was, you know. They knew that he was a serious artist. And, you know, you can tell a lot about a young person. I mean, Patricia and I are parents, and Rick is a parent. And, you know, I knew when my daughter was six, I knew a lot about her. You know, you don't know everything, but you know a lot about somebody if you're willing to listen. And that's what Patricia means when she says the 9 meetings. All they did is talk about music and draw together and talk. And Rick got a sense of what he was looking for, a like-minded soul. I mean, this is a very autobiographical movie. The truth is, I mean, Rick doesn't say this, but this is about as personal a film as you can make. It's a lot more about Rick than it is about Eller or Lorelei or Patricia or me. Mm-hmm. I'm his good friend, and this is a deeply, deeply personal film, and he was looking for a compadre, you know? And he saw something in Eller where he saw a friend, you know?
Patricia, you're in the position in the movie, your character's in the position of the movie, of being the parent who's, at times over those 12 years, a single mother who has to make very tough decisions, sometimes having to move to a different house, to a different neighborhood, meaning a different school for the kids, because you don't have the money to stay where you are, or because you're leaving your husband and you have to move. And then the kids are unhappy, but you know, you have to do what you have to do. And so you're also the parent who sets the limits for them, because, you know, their father, played by Ethan Hawke, he's not the discipline type. He's more the, I'm going to teach you about life and we're going to have a good time type. And he does a great job at that. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I want to play a scene of you around the table with your two young children. This is from pretty early in the film. And you're telling them that you have to move because you're going to go back to school and you need to be closer to your mother, who's going to help take care of the kids while you're going back to school, so that you can be in a better position to have a career and support them. So here you are. Here's Patricia Arquette in a scene from Boyhood breaking the news to the kids.
So listen, guys, I want to talk to you about something, and you might not like this idea at first, but we're moving to Houston.
When?
Well, soon. We should be up by the 1st so we don't have to pay 2 rents next month.
No, Mother, we're not moving. Nope, nope. Sorry, Mom. Nope, nope.
Samantha, I have to go back to college so I can make us a better living. With this job, I can't take care of us the way I'd like to. I can't keep going this way. And Grandma said she'd help us out, and it would be nice to be near her.
Fine, Mother. You can do whatever you want, but we're not moving.
What about our friends?
Baby, we can email them or write. We can come back and visit. And guess what? This place that Grandma found us, you'll each have your own room. Right? And there's a pool.
Such a nice scene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you're working with Lorelei Linklater as the daughter, who's the, and in real life, she's the director's daughter. So when she's going the nope, nope, and making those popping sounds, yeah, was that something she came up with? Did somebody suggest
Rick
that she do that?
Rick had seen her do that to her mother. So Rick was like, Lorelei, throw in that thing you always do to your mom.
Great.
You know, that thing. Yeah.
So just in terms of parallels or not between your life and the movie, Patricia, when you became a mother, did you know how to set limits for your child? Did you know how to discipline them and, you know, tell them what they could and couldn't do? I don't know how much authority there was in your life when you were growing up. That's, some people have a knack for doing that, and some people really don't know how.
Well, I did have a pretty chaotic household. That's not to say it didn't have incredible things in it that other people didn't get. But I was a 20-year-old mom. I was a kid when I was a mom. So with my son Enzo, we really grew up together. And I, as a parent, of course, wanted to meet all my child's needs. Sometimes you have to make choices that the child doesn't like, and that's painful as a parent. And you try to sweeten in that change as best you can. But the fact that they're children, they don't look at all the realities of what things cost and bills and your auto insurance and health care. And they don't care about that. They just have had most of their needs met, expect them to be met, and don't like this change that's uncomfortable for them. It's a pretty thankless task, I think, being a single parent and trying to do all of the things and grow up along the way and make mistakes. But I think that's a little bit the beauty of what Richard gave me an opportunity to do, was to spend that much time with a person like that who wasn't completely apologetic but was doing the best that they could. You don't, as Ethan has said before, get to see that character often in movies or spend that much time with them.
She's really, she really powers through, you know. She's a single mother, and she goes back to school to get a degree, and she ends up doing what she wanted to do, which is teaching psychology at a college. But she's had to make a lot of sacrifices, and so have her children, in order for her to get to that place. But you get the feeling watching the movie that being a single mother is almost forcing her to go back to school and get that job, because that's how she sees she's going to be able to provide for them. And even though she makes some pretty bad choices along the way in terms of men, who she mm-hmm. wants to also help provide for them. But being a single mother at the age of 20, what kind of choices did that lead you to make in terms of your career?
Well, I've said before that as a 20-year-old young woman, my drug of choice was being in love. So I was a little bit in the clouds of just being in love and little things like, we're going to move in together, and what kind of couch should we get? And, you know, just that idea of being in a love bubble all the time. When I became a mom, the stakes changed so dramatically. There was a human being I had to provide for no matter what. And it changed my whole perspective towards my career. First of all, I had a lot of difficult feelings that I didn't have anywhere to put, and I felt that acting really gave me a great place to put these complicated feelings. And also I needed to support somebody. And right before him, I'd gotten my first big movie, and it was really a great art movie. It was Last Exit to Brooklyn. And it was a really star-making part, a great part. And between the time that they offered it to me and they started shooting, I discovered I was pregnant. And that character really goes through a lot of difficult things in that movie. And it was my first time having a baby, and I thought, I don't want to be pregnant and emotionally go through this woman's journey that's very violent at certain points with a baby inside me. And it was a very difficult moment where I sat down with the producers and they said, well, we think you could still shoot this while you're pregnant. I said, well, let me just walk around the block. And I came back and I said, I can't do this movie because I don't know how that will be for my baby. And I didn't know if I would ever get another movie. And when I, right after I had him, I'd audition and I wasn't getting movies. And I remember walking into this restaurant on Sunset Boulevard and saying, you know, applying for a job as a waitress. And I said, look, I'm smart. I don't have a lot of experience. I like people. I'm nice to people. I learn fast and I have a baby to feed. And they gave me the job and I was going to start on Wednesday. And that Monday, I got a call that I got my first movie after my son.
And which movie was that?
God, I can't even remember. It was just, I mean, I remember coming home from work being a single mom, having acted in a movie all night. I'd lay down on my bed, fall asleep with my shoes on, everything. I'd wake up and my son would be looking at me and blinking his eyes really fast. And I said, baby, what are you doing? He said, I'm just taking pictures of you.
Huh. Ethan Hawke, let's hear a scene from Boyhood that you're prominently featured in. And this is a scene in which you've picked up your kids and you're driving with them and they're in the back seat and you're trying to talk with them about how their day has been. And they're giving you these like one word, like reluctant one word, you know, answers. They're kind of, I think they're in like their young teens at this point. And you're trying to get them to actually like talk to you. So here's a scene from Boyhood featuring my guest, Ethan Hawke.
Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week?
I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an A, right? Mason, how was your week?
Well, Dad, you know, it's kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them, but I said no because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer about what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay. Okay, that's good. See? That's I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it.
But, Dad, I mean, why is it all on us, though? You know, what about you? How was your week? You know, who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point.
So we should just let it happen more naturally, right? That's what you're saying. Okay, that's what we'll do. Starting now.
I love that scene. It's a scene from Boyhood with, I guess, Ethan Hawke, and also with us is Patricia Arquette. So did that scene come out of anybody's experience of trying that with their kids?
Well, that scene could be a good example if you want to know how we made this movie, which is that, you know, so we all haven't seen each other in a while. This is the dramatization of the every other weekend with Dad moment. And he picks them up and he's going to take them to a baseball game and they're just going to have their little weekend. They go to a museum, you know, all the stuff divorced dads do. And Rick knows I want a scene driving to the baseball game. What do we talk about? And I say, well, if it's like my kids, nothing. And, you know, and Rick laughs and goes, I know, me too. And the kids say, because that's the wonderful thing, is that because I'm not their parent, you know, we're in a rehearsal context. And Eller goes, why do parents always say that? They don't ever tell anything personal about their life, you know? And Rick and I look at each other and go, that's a scene. That's a scene. Let's do that. And part of learning to be a dad is we have these agendas with ourselves. I want to be this kind of dad. I want my son to be this kind of person. I want my daughter to be this kind of person. And it's so hard for us to just live with our kids and understand the truth is that our life is our message. We can try to say, you know, pick up your clothes and clean the kitchen and do all this, and it needs to be done, close the door. But if we live an orderly life, if we do pay our bills, that's the biggest thing that they will take from us. You know, if you do follow your dreams, if you do put love first, or do you put money first? That doesn't matter what you say. You know, it's what you do. And what this scene is about is, I think, Mason Sr. starting to learn to just trust and live with his kids. And that's why I like it.
I also love this scene because my character, Olivia, is bogged down with the practical realities of life all the time. And again, this quality that Mason Sr. has, she doesn't really see. This beautiful quality, because he cares about who these kids are inside. Gently prying them open, opening the door, telling them somebody cares, someone wants to hear what you have to say. You are each individual's. Who are you? Let's figure out. Let me know. I want to know. I care. What are you interested in? That's important to me, too. I love you, basically.
You know, and it's funny, Patricia talking about, you know, being a young mom. Well, my dad was 19 when I was born. And so, you know, I could do that scene and look at Lorelai and know that I was older than Lorelai than my father was than I was. You know, and really taking in and seeing when my father used to take me to baseball games. My parents were split up. And all of a sudden, I'm acting out this role that my father did. I mean, my father took me to baseball games in Texas. I mean, I lived this scene from both points of view. I've been the dad in this scene with picking my kids up every other weekend, and I've been the son, you know, and it was kind of profound for me to see this family dynamic from both angles.
So now that Boyhood is over, do you still think about the characters? And do you still wonder, like, what would they be doing now? What would the next chapter be if the film wasn't finished yet?
I have some feelings about, because the movie's a little so autobiographical about Rick, and there's so many weird crossovers between all of us and our parents, I have some knowledge of where I think Olivia would be, but it's not something I would want to share with anyone.
Yeah.
I still want Rick to keep making this movie, so it's very hard for me to let go of that.
For me, the biggest question of this whole Boyhood experiment was, could Rick end it? You know, is that when it came to be over, would you feel you were told a story? I mean, that's what we used to talk about. And I remember when he showed me the first cut, it was just, you know, it was like if getting punched in the gut could feel good. That's what it was like. I couldn't believe he'd finished it and he'd sailed it into port. There's something so beautiful about the final moments of the movie, and it was clear to me that it's about an adult being born, you know? And so, yeah, I'd love to see Mason Sr. get older. I'd like to see where he goes and what the evolution of his thought might be. But that said, the magic of the movie is that it is over.
Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette star in the film Boyhood, which is nominated for 6 Oscars. The 87th Academy Awards take place on February 22nd. Coming up, we'll hear Terry's interview with the creators and stars of Comedy Central's Broad City, Abby Jacobson and Ilana Glazer. This is Fresh Air Weekend. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with the creators and stars of Comedy Central's Broad City, Abby Jacobson and Ilana Glazer. They play single 20-somethings named Abby and Ilana, who live in New York, have dead-end jobs, and spend a lot of time hanging out together. In The New Yorker Online, Rachel Ahrens wrote, "The show's rough enough to inhabit the bro-dominated world of Comedy Central, but it's also surreal and strange." Earlier this week, Dave Itzkoff wrote in The New York Times, "In 10 episodes last year, Broad City offered an absurdist slapstick look at two women scraping by in New York. They have each other's backs through apartment lockouts, minor drug deals, and the occasional hurricane, and it becomes clear they care far more about getting into a Lil Wayne concert than getting anywhere on the ladder of life." Jacobson and Glazer met through the improv comedy group The Upright Citizens Brigade, which was co-founded by Amy Poehler, now an executive producer of Broad City. The show started its second season this week. Let's begin with a scene from Broad City's first season. Here, Abby and Ilana are in Ilana's apartment, sitting together on a couch and looking at their laptops.
Oh my goodness. This dude, Brian DeGlare, I went to high school with, just friended me. He just moved here.
Oh my God. People from high school only friend you, like, after business hours if they want to hook up.
Really? I had a huge crush on him.
Ah, you should ask him out.
I can't just do that.
Oh my God. He likes Roseanne? Okay, this is your new sexual partner.
All right. I'm asking you out. I'm just gonna do it.
Do it. This is so great. Like, why are we waiting for guys to come to us, Ilana? Did Amelia Earhart wait to be asked to fly around the world? Definitely not. She asked. And then they said no. But she still did it.
And she died? But she, like, died doing it.
Exactly. I'm doing it again. I'm asking someone else out.
This is the Abby I love and fell in love with and I'm obsessed with.
Skylar Cummins Conkleman, I used to babysit for him. He was adorable. He's 20. That's acceptable.
Troy Megliarino. He spent a hot second in jail, but he lives in South Jersey, and I know he'd steal a car and come up for the night.
Chris Wasileski. He was a nude model in my life drawing class, and he, like, always angled himself out to me.
Chad Michael Fung. We met at a hardware store. He was disgusting. I'm gonna go with this.
Okay, who else?
Henry Rowdenbush had a unibrow all through middle school, and then he started waxing it, and all of a sudden it was like, glasses off, you're f-ing gorgeous.
It's like she's all that. I feel like I'm on coke right now. PJ Mallory.
Bobby Kornhauser.
Johnny Fissinger.
Benny McCarra.
Ryan Long.
Rod White.
We are like feminist heroes right now. Yeah!
So, okay, that's 36 guys that we've been rejected by and one lady.
Okay, so what, dude? You know what? The internet is so 90s. Let's go find some guys IRL.
You know, you can just say in real life it's the same number of syllables.
That's from season one of Broad City. Abby Jacobson, Ilana Glazer, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to each describe your character in Broad City.
We sort of wrote these characters and write these characters sort of as us before we found Broad City. So she's 26. She's an illustrator, but hasn't yet been able to make that her career. So in the meantime, she currently works at this high-end gym as a janitor, cleaning all sorts of disgusting things up, mostly bodily fluids and remnants. but dreams of bigger things.
Ilana, describe your character.
A free spirit, very loyal. She's a stoner. She's a hedonist. She likes to feel good. She likes pleasure. I feel like at this point in her life, the most important thing is her friendship with Abby. That's like a grounding through line for my character.
When you were starting Broad City as a web series, and then as you transitioned into an actual program, did you have a sense of what you were as a show and what you weren't? For instance, like, you know, when Girls started, it was compared to Sex and the City. And when you started, your show was compared with Girls. Did you make comparisons like that in your own mind? Or did you see yourself on, like, a different track?
You know, the webisodes were such slices that they were really just, I feel like, for tone. And character development. We didn't realize it was going to be character development for a TV show later, but I think we looked to Larry David more mm-hmm. than anybody else.
Yeah, we did the web series from 2009 through 2011, and I think it was like Curb, Seinfeld, and Louis was just starting.
Yeah, we talked about Louis a lot.
Because they were these short slices that didn't wrap up usually, or they were just sort of little segments of these characters' lives.
However, our lives are reflecting Sex and the City more than ever now that we're, like, becoming the age of the characters. We talk about Sex and the City a lot and have seen all those episodes. And I definitely see overlap with Girls, with the content, with tone, with characters, like the characters could be friends or be at the same party or something. But I think that comparison was more just a result of the reductiveness of like a headline, for example.
What do you talk about when you talk about Sex and the City?
Oftentimes in the writer's room,
oh my God,
when we are pitching ideas, you know, we have the pleasure of working with a lot of our best friends who write on the show. And when we're talking about just something that's happened to us, whether it's a sexual encounter or a friend thing, oftentimes someone else will be like, that was a Sex and the City episode, so we can't do that. they've covered a lot of ground that is still extremely relevant and relatable.
So it sounds like in order to write the show, you and your co-writers, part of what you do is sit in a room and share some of the most awful and embarrassing things that have happened to you.
Exactly. And also amazing things that have happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
We try to do like the most New York, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's more like that. Like there's definitely universal experiences to be had, but the funniest one, like Abby in the first season with the mail, with the package, going to North Brother Island for the package, like that's just so New York centric. Getting a package in New York City is different than getting a package anywhere else. Like our show's a lot about suburban transplants still being in awe of the city, even when it's a really annoying result that you have to endure.
I feel like I think about our show a lot where it's as if you're like walking through just this gross block and there's just trash and people peeing and spitting on you, and then you turn the corner and look up and it's like, oh, right, I'm in New York. This is, like, the most beautiful city in the world.
Well, and yeah, then there's a scene on the subway where there literally is a pile of feces in the middle of the subway
yeah,
car.
Yes.
And people in New York have probably been exposed to worse.
Yeah.
And well, another thing you're both exposed to as, you know, your characters are exposed to as young women, young single women in Manhattan, is that, you know, men are brushing up against you and rubbing against you in awkward places. And I'm sure that's something like every young woman in New York has had to deal with, especially on like crowded subways, crowded stores.
Ew. So it's true.
Do you sit around the writer's room like talking about, and here's what happened to me?
Yeah, all those little details are never lost.
We like love the mundane. It cracks us up, the minutiae, the muck. It is like this sick, masochistic romance that New Yorkers have with the city where they love how tough they are. And like friends who move to LA are like, over it, later. Like, but there's some sort of pride that New Yorkers have. Somebody texted me the other day who had seen that episode at our premiere party, Phoebe Robinson, stand-up comedian.
Who that happened to? It happened to
me. Did she tell you?
No.
It
happens every so often. A car comes down through the subway.
She walked in. Everybody's running out.
I know.
She doesn't know why.
But that is like the real car.
Nobody invented that one.
I want to play a short clip from what will be episode 4 of the new season. And in this scene, Abby, you are with your neighbor, Jeremy, who, you know, you're attracted to. And this is the day, well, you know, Alana's grandmother has just died. And so you're saying to him that, you know, you're talking to him about how death has been on your mind. And you both have some, I don't know if it's wine or champagne, I don't know exactly what you're drinking, but you have that in your hands. And here's the scene.
You know, I've been surrounded by a lot of death lately, too. And sometimes death really makes me think about life.
I totally agree.
To life. And to remember and to be. And that's it.
You're really eloquent about death.
Well, my favorite TV show is 6 Feet Under, so that's probably why.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen 6 Feet Under? Oh, God. You're so lucky. You know, I have the box set if you want to borrow it.
Maybe we could watch it together sometime.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If you want to.
I definitely do.
Okay.
It'll be great.
I think it's a really funny scene.
This will be great.
Because obviously, like, your frame of reference for death is a TV series. And your profound thought about death is so, like, not profound. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about writing that scene, Abby?
Yeah, I mean, I have had actual death in my life, but a real thing is that Six Feet Under is my favorite show of all time. And as weird as it sounds, is a wonderful portrayal of life and death.
I agree.
But I think that show was a really big influence for me in writing because it is so dramatic, but it is so funny and deals with such dark things. It's such a wonderful dark comedy.
But I also think we were, like, capturing, like, how stupid dates are.
Oh.
And how, like, you're just trying to, like, in this day and age, like, trying to seem real. It's, like, so hard. There's so much, like, surreality and virtual reality and cyber reality. Like, all this, like, weird distortion of reality. It's, like, funny to quiet down and actually hear this character try to be real.
Ilana Glazer and Abby Jacobson are the co-creators and stars of the Comedy Central series Broad City, which began its second season earlier this week. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Musician Ty Siegel is a prolific 27-year-old who does it all. Writes, sings, produces, plays guitar and drums. He's a member of several bands and has also put out many solo albums. Siegel's latest release is a 4-song EP called Mr. Face. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Sometimes I feel as though I almost owe Ty Siegel an apology. The kid has released an album a year for the past 7 years, put out numerous singles, EPs, even cassettes of new music. This, in addition to performing as part or most of at least 6 other bands, including Fuzz and the Epsilons. All this work, and I've never reviewed a Ty Siegel project here. As a kind of New Year's resolution, I told myself I'd tackle the next thing Siegel released. And that turned out to be Mr. Face, a 4-song EP that's a terrific showcase for Siegel's artfully ragged style. He plays everything on these recordings with the exception of one drum part on one song. Ty Siegel is deeply influenced by music recorded before he was born or when he was very young. He has cited as influences everyone from the Grateful Dead to the Velvet Underground to Kiss. He uses the phrase super noisy to characterize some of his best music, which partakes of the bash-it-out philosophy of 60s garage rock and 70s punk. A song on the new EP called Circles begins with a 30-second drum solo, followed by a song that achieves maximum intensity right from the start of Siegel's vocal. The entire song is a plaintive wail about the difficulties of a relationship based on endless analyzing of the relationship.
I remember you, dear.
Siegel knows how to have fun. The Mr. Face EP comes on 2 7-inch discs that double as a pair of 3D glasses. If you're looking to increase your Ty Siegel collection, I highly recommend his solo albums Manipulator and Twins, a compilation of non-album songs called Singles 2, and the Fuzz 2013 album. Sure, there's some self-indulgence in Siegel's work, and some repetition if you listen to big chunks of his discography. But self-indulgence in the service of creating the kind of passion produced when you pour out everything is a rewarding indulgence. And who besides a music critic re-listens to a half dozen albums by the same artist in one sitting? Ty Siegel knows that's not how most people consume music. He knows that his listeners are looking for something fresh and new that nevertheless links up to a grand tradition of flat-out, revved-up rock and roll. And he gives it to them. He gives it to them a lot.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Ty Siegel's new 4-song EP called Mr. Face. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.